It will go live here. And we'll open up the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for February 7th, 2012. We'll open up a public hearing for SCR 207. Gail, do you want to? Beth, do you want to just say what's this about? And then we'll hear about Gail.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, SCR 207 honors Gail Achterman. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the bill.
Okay, thank you. We have the governor here who would like to kick off the testimony on SCR 207. I wish that the governor is here for another reason, for a more positive note, but really pleased to have you here, Governor. Why don't you come up and kick us off? And the chair will probably wait until the end to say her comments. Thank you and welcome to the committee. It's good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Kitzhaber, Governor of the State of Oregon, and I want to appear before you briefly to speak in support of this resolution. And I don't have any prepared remarks. I just took a few notes, a few things I'd like to put in the record. Again, I wish I were here under other circumstances. I first met Gail Achterman in 1986, following her appointment by then Governor Goldschmidt to be his natural resource advisor. And I was president of the Senate at the time, and we just passed the Gorge Act in 1986 and appointed the first Gorge Commission in 1987, and Gail was extraordinarily involved in shepherding that through. We rewrote the Oregon Forest Practices Act during that same period of time and came out with a consensus a package that was supported both by the conservation community and by the timber industry. And I guess one of the things I took away from that was her deep belief in the power of collaboration and the necessity of getting actually to yes on many of these natural resource issues. She used to say on many occasions, "I know this will be difficult, but we need to make it work." And I think that was really one of the hallmarks of her career. As you know, she went on to be the executive director of the Deschutes Resources Conservancy. She served as the first director of the Institute of Natural Resources at Oregon State University, and I appointed her to the Transportation Commission in 2000. When I think back on Gail and her career, I think of the breadth and scope of the challenges that she undertook. I mean, if you've driven through the Columbia River Gorge, that is a huge and a daunting project, and it's been a tremendous legacy and a tremendous accomplishment. The effort to improve water quality and stream flows in the Deschutes River Basin, again, not small ball, something large and truly challenging. Her efforts to connect the 70% of Oregonians who live in the Willamette Valley with their river, with their watershed, another huge accomplishment that I think built community far beyond the natural resource aspects of that project. And, of course, her effort to connect natural resource policy to good evidence-based science. These contributions, I think, are a rich legacy that will last for years. And they will remind us of her work and of the beautiful person she was. Whenever we drive through the gorge, whenever we raft the Deschutes, whenever we gaze at the Willamette River, whenever we see a natural resource dispute solved with consensus, Gail will be with us. But not only did she fight for the land, she also enjoyed it. She hiked it, she climbed it, she rafted it, she lived it. And I think that I'd like to just close with a little quote that I think captures a lot of who Gail was and what she left us. It's actually a quote from Edward Abbey, not necessarily a consensus builder. From a speech in Montana, which was definitely not a consensus speech. But it is what it is. And here it is. "It is not enough to fight for the land. It is even more important to enjoy it while you can, while it's still here. So get out there and hunt and fish and mess around with your friends. Ramble out yonder and explore the forests, climb the mountains, bag the peaks, run the rivers, breathe deep of that yet sweet and lucid air. Sit quietly for a while and contemplate the precious stillness, the lovely, mysterious, and awesome space. Enjoy yourselves, keep your brain in your head, keep your head firmly attached to your body, the body active and alive, and I promise you this. I promise you this one sweet victory over our enemies, those desk-bound men and women with their hearts in a safety deposit box and their eyes hypnotized by a desk calculator. I promise you this, you will outlive the bastards. Gale may not have outlived the bastards, whoever they are, literally, but her work and her accomplishments will live on for generations to come. She was a good friend, a generous public servant, great Oregonian, and we will miss her. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. Yep. Really appreciate you being here today, and it means a lot to, I know, her family and friends that are in the room, and to all of us.
Great. Thank you.
I know that's a tough act to follow, but we have a few other elected officials that wanted to say a few words, Senator Johnson. And I just want to mention that real briefly, I met Gale about 18 years ago when I first moved to the state, and I actually worked for her, and I will tell you she was not an easy boss. But she was a mentor for me, a friend, somebody I could always pick up the phone and call, or meet with or get on my bike and bounce some ideas off of. And when I think about all the things Gale has done for the state, this was one small thing that I felt that the legislature could do to honor her. And I do want to say that, just mention that there's her family, her husband, her brother, her stepson and daughter-in-law in the room today, along with a lot of friends. And just thank you all for being here and honoring her spirit. And thank you, Senator Johnson, for coming here as well.
Thank you. This is going to be difficult.
Yeah.
For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16. Important safety tip, never follow John Kitzhaber to the podium.
Especially that he almost tripped over you. So it's like
members of the committee, but more especially to Gale's beloved family. This obit from the January 31st Oregonian, as beautifully written as it was, does not begin to do justice to the brilliant, provocative, groundbreaking, funny woman that was Gale Ackerman. As late as Christmas time, I was on the telephone with Gale talking policy issues scheduled to come before this legislative session. As always, she was insightful, wise, well-informed, opinionated, and coincidentally right about the issue at hand. While she sounded robust, there was no one close to Gale who could ignore the cancer lurking inside her. We all had walked beside her as she openly chronicled her heroic fight to outfox and outlive the relentless disease that ultimately and untimely ended her extraordinary life. When we spoke last December, I simply couldn't imagine the remainder of her life could be measured in only weeks. I urge this committee and ultimately the entire legislature, I'm sorry, to memorialize this amazing woman by passing the resolution before you. Thank you. I apologize.
Thank you, Senator. Really appreciate you being here. We have a few other folks that would like to come up. Lynn Peterson and Matt Garrett. I think you wanted to come up together. Thank you for being here today and for sharing your thoughts about Gale.
Can I go first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation and had the privilege of working with Gale Ackerman. We have sent you, my commission, myself, we've sent you a letter of support. I truly appreciate the words. And the passion contained in the resolution. I want you to know on behalf of ODOT, my agency, we support it, we embrace the language of this resolution. We lost a giant. With Gale's passing, we lost one of the greatest public servants the state of Oregon has ever known. In her words and her deeds, she embodied the notion that public service is a noble cause. Foundational to her was the understanding that she served something greater than herself. She understood that each and every discussion that we had, policy debate, the directions we sent out from the commission to the agency affected the lives of Oregonians on a daily basis. The gravity of that was never lost with Gale. She was an amazing person. She treated all that came before her with a respect, a patience, and a grace, no matter their disposition, no matter their motivation, or no matter their station in life. I had the privilege of staffing Gail, but soon found out you did not staff Gail. She staffed you. She staffed you on the issue area you were engaged in, but more importantly, she staffed you on life. Her fingerprints are on all the major policies, programs, and projects that we animate and we build across this great state. Gail was many things, but I do believe at her core, she was a teacher. She taught you about life. She taught you about issues. And if you listened and you paid attention, you grew both professionally and personally because of these teachings and because of her presence in your life. In her 62 years, she taught us much. And in the final months, weeks, and days, she taught us how to live life. And maybe more importantly, how to face death with courage, passion, and honesty. She was a very special woman on so many different levels. She was touched by the hand of God, there is no question in my mind. And she blessed everyone that she touched. Thank you, Madam Chair. I truly appreciate this resolution, and thank you for allowing me. I'm humbled to be here to present before you in the committee.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder and committee members, Lynn Peterson, Sustainable Communities and Transportation Advisor to the Governor. Thank you for consideration of the resolution recognizing Gail. Gail worked her whole life on connecting the dots for us and herself between the environment, social, and economic realms. She was, in my opinion, a true conservationist. And having grown up in Wisconsin and moved to the state of Oregon, I was coached on the land ethic and conservational ethic of Eldo Leopold, and I never obviously met Eldo Leopold, but she is as close as I feel I will ever get to knowing somebody who, with the same background and interests and true passion for understanding how things work. As Eldo Leopold wrote, conservation is a state of harmony between men and land. Harmony with land is like harmony with a friend. You cannot cherish his right hand and chop off his left. That is to say, you cannot love game and hate predators. You cannot conserve the waters and waste the ranges. You cannot build the forest and mine the farm. Its parts, like our own parts, compete with each other and cooperate with each other. If the land mechanism as a whole is good, then every part is good, whether we understand it or not. To keep every cog and wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering. Gail wanted to understand the way things worked. You could see the cogs and the wheels working in her own head. Whether it was a wetlands ecosystem or the Oregon State driver simulation software package, she wanted to balance realistic political gains with the ultimate vision of multiple modes in Oregon. She wanted to understand and maximize the use of geographic information systems and data to increase the understanding of not only how freight moves, but also as tracking impacts to the Willamette River. But most importantly, she wanted us all to work together for an outcome we could all live with. Gail's leadership brought everyone to the table. Everyone had a chance to help define the issue and potential solutions. I want to thank you for recognizing Gail. I want to thank Gail for teaching us about the complexity of Oregon, valuing the diversity, and expecting the rest of us to do the same. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you both for being here today and testifying. We have a few more folks that would like to come up. Ann Hannis, and here, Lisa Gaines, and Lynn Parton.
Yeah, I think you're going to have to pass that down. Yeah. For the record, I'm Ann Hannis. I'm with you. Thank you. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm also here on a personal level. I believe that Gail epitomizes the servant leader, and she dedicated herself to make this state a better place, and I know that she left it that way as well. She Her vocation and avocation was the love of Oregon. I first met her when we were working on the federal forest plans in the 1980s, and we traveled all over Oregon together. She would travel by car, by foot, by bike, by ski, by raft, however way she could. And she knew this state like no other person knew this state in every inch. I do want to recognize the role that Gail played with the counties. She was an immense help to us because of her in-depth, brilliant mind. She was able to understand so deeply issues across many different areas, from land use to transportation to natural resources, like no other. It is with a great loss that we have had. Thank you very much.
Madam Chairwoman and the committee, my name is Lisa Gaines, and for the last year I've served as the interim director for the Oregon University Systems Institute for Natural Resources, and for the previous 6 years as its associate director, and worked under Gail for all of those years, and it's a privilege to be here and an honor to have worked for her. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about what I know of her as an Oregonian, as a colleague, as a mentor, and as a friend. As an Oregonian, she definitely called Oregon home no matter where she was in the world, if she was doing work at the national level, if she traveled abroad, if she was here at home, if she was here at home in our office. And I definitely consider her a homemaker. As she was committed to understanding and improving the organizational, financial, and management structures of Oregon's natural and built environments. She had a vision for Oregon, a passion for the Willamette Valley's past, present, and future, and a willingness to be a part of creating livable communities. For many reasons, both personal and professional, this was a lifelong and lifetime commitment that was demonstrated through her achievements and her advocacy for making investments that build communities, restore environments, and build our economy. As a colleague, she was always abuzz with ideas. They would just come left and right, and it was so exciting. It was a very exciting place to be. But nonetheless, she was steadfast in her ability to make connections between people and place, land use and water resource planning, transportation and conservation, environment and economy. She didn't seem willing or able or wanting to sacrifice one issue at the expense of another. And as a result, she was great at convening and a wonderful person to have dialogues with. For her, a challenge only provided an opportunity to reimagine and build a sustainable path to the future. She advocated for developing new tools and management systems for addressing the challenges we face. And she willingly and ably committed herself and contributed her leadership and problem-solving skills to these challenges. She understood that better results came from partnering with others, not doing it on your own. And she knew that facts mattered when making decisions. She was very committed to the Institute for Natural Resources and its ability to be able to facilitate the use of science in natural resources decision-making. As a mentor and as a friend, she was in high demand, and she liked it. And it was wonderful. She thrived at the university. She was involved with new faculty. She was involved with new students. She was involved with the president. She was involved with the vice president for research. She wanted to be on any committee that would help further the cause and a vision for Oregon, for its people and its landscapes. And always, she was very committed and very approachable. For a person that had such endeavors, it was very easy to come and talk to her. The last time we visited, 2 weeks before her passing, she continued to express her vision for Oregon, the Willamette Valley, developing regional ecological frameworks. And I sat there and listened. She was committed. She recognized and also spoke about her commitment to the Institute for Natural Resources. Though she'd been retired for a year, she spoke in terms of we have something to offer. We are doing this great stuff. We have a great vision. We have a great future. And she wanted to keep her ideas fresh and vibrant. And she expressed that. And we saw that on her Willamette strategies. We saw that on the Caring Bridge. We see that in many aspects of her life. And she regarded me as a friend as well as a colleague. And that was truly an honor. And whether or not we agreed with her vision or how she approached moving ahead with that vision, or the outcomes of her projects, or whether or not she disagreed with others. She did it with such grace, and she did it with respect. But most importantly, she was just down to earth and so likable. When I think about her life and her contribution to Oregon, I just ask that we choose to utilize her example and her commitment to confront difficult issues by working together, trying to use facts and research to inform decisions, and not be afraid to challenge convention. I encourage everyone to think, upon mourning her death and celebrating her life, that her contributions are not a memory, but can continue to be a part of our road path toward a better Oregon.
Thank you, Lisa. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lynn Parton. I apologize for not having any written testimony. My original plan was to be a fly on the wall, and I thought I might have a couple of things. It would be a little different perspective than probably most of the other people who are testifying. To me, Gail was a friend and a mentor. The first invitation that my husband and I received for dinner at somebody's home when we moved here 27 years ago was from Gail and Chuck. Gail and I probably each had a little bit too much wine. We got in a big argument about BLM policies, especially about wild horse management and the use of Compound 1080 and predator control. But we were very good friends ever since, and in fact, she helped me out a lot when I first got here. My situation at the time was that I had a bar exam under my belt, and I had been practicing law in Washington, D.C. for a few years, but there was no reciprocity here, and so I had to take another bar exam, and there was almost a year before I was going to be employable in Oregon. And in the meantime, my husband was a first-year associate at Stoll Reeves, and when he wasn't working 24/7 there, he was studying for the bar, so I had nothing that was my own. And she got me involved in a campaign so that I would have my own friends and something constructive to do with my time for someone whose portrait is now behind a fake potted tree in a locked, dark legislative library, but who at the time was considered a rising national star and for whom she later worked as natural resources policy advisor. And I saw her in various situations, from the usual 700 suspects at the Stoll Reeves holiday parties to the one-on-one lunches we had both times that I ran for the legislature, where she gave me her much-appreciated political advice, personal endorsement, and financial support. One of the things that I'm glad of about her life is that she did receive a lot of accolades while she was here. I've been at a number of lunches and other ceremonies where she came away with a plaque or an armful of roses or both, and I'm very glad about that. One of the things I'm sad about is that she and my husband and I all graduated from the University of Michigan Law School, and we kept talking about, you know, how we would all like, how fun it would be to go back to Ann Arbor, all of us together, and obviously we're not going to do that now. So I just want to thank you so much for having this bill. I think it's really appropriate that it's in this committee, as opposed to all the other honoraria, which are in rules, of course, which is the norm. This is tremendously, I think it's a really appropriate thing for it to be here, and I would urge the members of the committee to pass it out with a do-pass recommendation to the Senate floor, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming here today and testifying. That's all that we have signed up. Is there anybody else that would like to come up and say a few words about Gail? With that, we will close the public hearing on SCR 207. I will open up a work session on SCR 207. And we do have an amendment. I want to say what the amendment does.
Madam Chair, the amendment corrects a mistake in the resolution that has to do with which governor appointed Gail to the Transportation Commission. So I'm just making it right.
It was It was the governor who was just here under his first term. Okay, with that, we are in a work session. I'll take a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 22-22-2012.
Okay, Senator Olson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 22-12. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. I'll take a motion on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chair Dingfelder, is with greatest pleasure and my honor to move SCR 207 as amended to the floor to be adopted, or with the be adopted recommendation.
Okay, Senator Olson moves SCR 207 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, I guess I'll just add that I will echo many of the comments, very thoughtful comments that we heard here today. It's going to be a huge loss for, obviously, friends and family, but also for the state of Oregon. And I think the purpose of this resolution, though, is to commemorate and honor her, all the amazing work she did for the people of Oregon, and remember her spirit. And I know personally, as I mentioned, Gail had a big part of my life. She was a mentor. For me, there was not a lot of women working in the natural resources arena, especially in law and policy, when I first met Gail almost 20 years ago. And I know there's a whole line of people in the state that are sorely going to miss her, in addition, of course, to the dear friends and family that are here today. And so with that, I will ask the clerk to call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder. Aye. The motion passes. The memorial is adopted, and I will carry the memorial on the floor. And with that, we will close the work session on SCR 207. Thank you all for being here and sharing your thoughts. And we will look forward, if you're able to come back when the memorial is on the floor, probably next week.
Mm-hmm. I'll let you know.
Yeah, we'll let folks know. Thank you again. Okay. So next up, I'm going to open up a public hearing on, reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 1513. And Beth already gave an introduction on this. I will say a few words before we hear this bill, because I think it is somewhat apropos that we are hearing a water rights bill just after hearing the resolution on Gail Achterman, because Gail Achterman was one of the one of the foremost water law attorneys in the state. And I spent a lot of time learning and listening and working with Gail on water rights issues, on water issues. And some of you probably know we're in the process right now of working on an integrative water resources strategy for the state. And Gail was instrumental in helping shape that. So I thought it was very appropriate that we hear this bill in her honor, since we just was talking about her. With that, we had some folks that didn't get to testify last time, so we just reopened the public hearing. I think I'm going to have the agency, Water Resources Department, come up first, because we had a number of questions that we would have liked answered. The chair also has some questions that I would like to get on the record. So with that, we'll hear from the Water Resources Department, then we'll call up the rest of the witnesses. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Oregon Water Resources Department. This afternoon, I have with me Tom Paul, who is the Deputy Director of the Water Resources Department. And thank you for the opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 1513 that would simply remove a sunset date from an already existing program at the Water Resources Department. The name of the program is called Split Season Leasing. And as its name implies, this is a program where a water right holder is allowed to use their water right for beneficial purpose, usually agriculture, for part of a season, and then place the remaining water in stream for the remainder of the growing season. Formally putting the water in stream to beneficial use this way protects the water right and also has the added benefit of enhancing stream flows. This particular program has been in place for a decade and has worked well to the benefit of both irrigated agriculture and the environment. It's one of our smaller programs, but we have a good track record with this and are pleased to see this bill this afternoon.
Did you want to add anything?
Madam Chair, for the record, Tom Paul, Deputy Director, Oregon Water Resources Department. I don't have anything to add at this time. I'd be happy to help answer any questions that there may be.
Okay. I actually have some. So while you're up here, let's see. I have some notes here. So there were some questions that came up last time, and then I had some additional questions. Just to make sure we get it on the record, because I don't think we addressed these last time. First of all, I was curious, has the agency ever received a complaint in regards to application for one of these leases? When I had the committee staff look at how many leases have been issued, I think it was just over a dozen since 2000. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. So I wanted to see if there's ever been a complaint in regards to any of these?
Madam Chair, no. There's been no complaint, no problems with the program.
Okay. And then also, if there was, what authority or obligation does the department have to address any issues that may be raised as a result of a complaint?
Madam Chair, again, for the record, Tom Paul. The statute authorizing in-stream leases is found in Chapter 537. Beyond that, we have adopted administrative rules, and the administrative rules talk about how we will deal with comments both before and after a lease is approved. The bottom line is that leases cannot cause injury to other water rights, and we look and do a test for injury beforehand. If we receive comments during the application process, we consider those comments as part of our review.
Well, that's a good segue, because my next question was, there was issues about or questions about junior water right holders, senior water right holders. You know, are there protections in place to make sure that nobody is cut off from their water with this process? So can you talk a little bit about that in particular? My notes from the last hearing, we want to make sure that this bill is in the program. This is a continuation of the existing program, is designed to protect junior water right users from harm that would also apply to the split season leases. I want to make sure that that's true.
Madam Chair, yes, the administrative rules direct us to take action if somebody alleges injury even after a lease, whether it be split season or regular, is approved. And we can either issue an order ending the lease, or we can put restrictions on so that the injury is no longer occurring. Leases do carry the priority date of the originating water right, so there may be regulation involved, but that would not be necessarily injury.
And so you have not, if I'm hearing correctly, you have not to date had to cut off or any of the existing rights. It hasn't been a problem. You haven't had a complaint.
Madam Chair, to date we have not received a complaint. After we have issued a lease or a split season lease, it has not caused our water master to go out and either regulate or not regulate to satisfy it. And additionally, we have not had to, withdraw a lease or issue an order ending a lease due to a complaint.
One last question I had, and then we'll call up, we'll see if there's other questions for the department, and then we'll call up the rest of the witnesses. There was some a notion floating around that the water going into the split season stream leases is excess water. I think it would be helpful for folks to hear that, you know, how you just determine, you know, what can go in stream versus what goes to a junior water right holder. I think there are some misconceptions about that, and if you can maybe clarify how you make those determinations, be helpful.
Okay, Madam Chair, again, Tom Paul. Split season lease, one of the requirements is that the water user must measure and report water use before they can do a split season lease or as part of a split season lease. Water rights are very specific. It talks about a use, a place of use, the source of water, how much water can be used, the maximum quantity that can be used beneficially without waste. The split season lease program would allow a water right holder to use the lease part of the year to satisfy some of their irrigation demand. An example would be pasture or hay, where the water right holder elects to irrigate and get a couple cuttings of hay or really water up the pasture to begin with in the season, and then later in the year decides that it would be better to lease part of it in stream, that maybe the production wouldn't be as great for the hay, or to give up a second or third cutting of hay in favor of in stream. The water that was used to satisfy the irrigation need in the beginning and the water that is protected in stream combined can't exceed the maximum rate and duty that's contained on the water right. So that's one look. And then the additional look in it on top of that would be to assure that injury is not occurring to existing water rights.
Okay. That's all the questions I had. I know that Senator Thompson had some questions last time, and I'm going to see if you have some more for the department.
I got a couple more.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair Greenfeller. Last year we had House Bill 2983 come out of the House to this committee. Did you support that bill last year?
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe, thinking back to that bill, there were a couple of additional components to that the department was not comfortable with.
Do you remember what that was, or was it mainly just the five-year look back on these leases?
I believe that bill also had mentions of fee and fee reductions in there, and so that was a component that
did
not
you have an issue with the looking at this thing, like if somebody leases this long term, like can anybody come in and sign up for a 25-year lease on a in stream on splitting streams, or is it year to year? Is it 5 years? Is it 20 years? 100 years?
Senator, it's a 5-year program, 5-year lease. Right. It can be renewed, but it's 5 years.
Right, and that's in rules, right? That's not in statute.
That's
so
correct.
That could be changed at any time.
It's in rule, yes, Senator.
Right.
Yeah, just to clarify, Senator, that the agency has to go through what's called the Administrative Procedures Act. So in order to change a rule, they have to do a public process similar to a public hearing like what we do.
Right. Yeah, follow-up?
Follow-up.
The amendment number 3, I have an issue with that. Do you think that, does that eliminate, in your opinion, because I think you can read it several different ways, do you think that eliminates any of the protections under the transfer statutes 540, 505 through 545, 585?
Madam Chair, Senator, the Dash 3 amendment, is that what you're looking at, referring to? I believe that does not eliminate any of the protections afforded under those statutes. In fact, I think it's a confirmation of what we currently have in rule and practice today that involves those standards and those protections afforded to folks in the program and water right holders.
Okay, and I guess the...
You are supposed to ask for a follow-up.
Follow-up. Can I have a follow-up? I guess you folks have spent a lot of time on this. We spent a lot of time on this. In 10 years, we've had 12 of these things. Why... If this is such a great thing, why do we not advertise this? Why aren't we doing this? We spend a lot of time up here, and you folks have spent a lot of time on this. Why have only 12 people used this, in your opinion?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's one of our smaller programs. It's true we don't do a lot of active advertising, but we like to have those tools in the toolbox for making sure that water right holders that need those tools have access to them.
I think we'll also have some people up here that do advertise the program that can talk a little bit about that. It's a 501c3 that does a lot of work in the program.
So.
Other questions?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you. It was very nice that Ms. Bateman and Mr. Paul had come to my office and we discussed this issue and clarified a lot of points, but there are two things that I want to get on the record. And the first is, you had told me in my office that junior water right holders cannot be harmed by this bill, and I want that on the record, that they cannot be harmed by this bill. Either one could answer.
Yeah, I was going to say the nodding can't be heard on the tape, so you may want to just say that.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the statute talks about leasing and gives the process. Our administrative rules clearly say that you can't injure a test when we're reviewing water right transfers is that you cannot injure by a water right transfer. That is the criteria we used. And again, as I talked earlier, our administrative rules go on farther when it applies to leases and says even with our quick review that we do, if injury develops, we have a process to address it to stop it at that time.
Okay, follow up?
Mm-hmm. We've talked about, and Senator Thompson most notably talked about the five-year lease, that five-year increments. And it is in statute. Is it easier, or in rules, I should say, is it easier to change a rule than it is a statute?
You may be asking the wrong people since they can't make laws, but...
I understand that.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it is a different process. You being the part of the decision-making body here, any changes to law, as you know, have to come before you. With administrative rules, proposals to change our administrative rules would go before our Water Resources Commission. Public input, public testimony, they go through a formal process to adopt or amend rules. It's similar as to process, but a different group of decision makers are taking the final action.
My only concern is that in rule, it appears, and I'm a novice to this, I admit this, but it appears that it would be easier to change that five-year lease status to 10 than it would be if you had to come before our committee and then take it to the floor and move it through as a law. And the good senator to my right could probably answer that question better than anyone here, whether that's true or not. And I think she's got that grin like she
I was going to say, the answer is it depends. I mean, seriously, one thing I will say about, without getting too much into what are founding fathers, and we heard from this morning it was founding fathers, not founding fathers and mothers, who made our original laws and constitution, we do have what's called a balance of power, and with that, the commissioners on the Water Resources Commission are actually appointed and have to be by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. So thus, we do have a system of checks and balances between the administrative branch, executive branch, and the legislative branch. I think this is probably a discussion that has gone on for hundreds of years, although I know the Administrative Procedures Act has not been around for hundreds of years. However, I think it was a good addition to making sure there's adequate public input. What I generally look at as far as the statutes versus rules is us as a... I feel like I'm in my political science class here, but I hope my professor isn't listening, is that we tend to provide policy direction to the agencies. The agencies are the experts on these issues. We often are not, unfortunately, even though we have general areas of expertise. And by having the experts, the water resources managers, hydrologists, people who the water right transaction folks, who dive into the details often in rules that we don't have the ability to develop. That's often why we have things through rulemaking versus through statute. As far as is it easier, I think it really depends. It depends on the issue, depends on the makeup of the legislature, probably from session to session. I don't necessarily think one is better than the other. As a legislator, of course, I'd like to say I'd like to put all the details in the law, but we don't always have that knowledge. And often things change. We may decide at some point that we want to have a shorter time because of, let me say this loud and clear, climate change and the concern about our changing environment. So it may be that at some point we come back and say, no, we really need to analyze this on, you know, every two-year basis. I think it provides more flexibility in the rules to respond to issues as they come up. And that's probably the biggest difference, I think, in the statute and the rule. What I'm hearing right now is it hasn't been a problem. There hasn't been any complaints. It's a tool in the toolbox. We have many, many other transactions that occur, transfers. I know it occurred at a much greater rate, which we also have to make sure and review that there is no injury with any type of request for a transfer. So just
one more follow-up after your.
I was going to say, so yeah. In summary, the answer is it depends, but
it depends.
That gives you a little bit of the philosophical background without getting too much into the...
I'd like to make one point. I don't know that there's any science in politics. But secondly, in your OARs, you have in this split-season use in-stream leasing, it says that the commission, which I would assume would be you folks, shall review the split-season use leasing program no later than the year 2014 to determine if any changes should be made in the program. So why are we moving this up a couple of years? And have you determined if there's any changes that need to be made?
Madam Chair, Senator, we have not, as part of our day-to-day operations, come across any problems that need to be addressed. And so we have that opportunity ongoing to evaluate. We certainly can evaluate in 2014, as is currently in our rules. And I think that evaluation can take place no matter what happens here today with this bill. But we've not encountered any problems. And I think the Commission will undertake that evaluation in 2014. We'll lay out all the same statistics and numbers that we've used today, and they'll be able to put together a summary from that.
Fellow, but my question was, why would you want to remove the sunset today when you haven't done any examination to that extent?
Madam Chair, Senator, as a department, we're planning to bring a bill forward in 2013 in time for that sunset change, but upon review of the program, we see no problems, so we believe it's timely and appropriate should the body decide to remove the sunset during the session as well.
Yeah. And just to clarify, Senator, this is a committee bill. The Water Resources Department did not request this bill. Okay. Actually, the chair, working with many of the folks who have been involved with this program for many years, actually brought it forward. So I just want to make sure that they're not that it's clear that this was not an agency request. However, they do support the bill and have no problems with the bill, is what I'm hearing.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you. If you can stick around in case there's other questions at the end.
Certainly.
So I have Joe Whitworth. David, do you need to come back up? I know you were up there before. Okay. And can I have Teresa Hunsinger?
It's wrong.
I'm going to get me in trouble for my... science professor's list. Okay, gentlemen, or ladies, whoever would like to start.
Go ahead,
yeah. Teresa, why don't you go ahead? You look like you're ready.
I was going to defer to Joe because Freshwater Trust is really the expert here. But my name is Teresa Hunsinger. I'm with the Oregon Environmental Council. I'm our program director for Clean and Plentiful Water. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you this afternoon. Oregon Environmental Council supports Senate Bill 1513, removing the sunset from the split-season in-stream leasing program. We think this is an effective program that's working well, that hasn't been having any problems, and so we think it makes sense to remove the sunset now in order to allow the program to continue to be one of those important tools in the toolbox for managing our water resources. One of the reasons we came to this position of supporting the program is that I've spent a lot of time in the past year going around the state interviewing irrigators and growers and ranchers and other irrigation experts to identify ways that we can advance water conservation and efficiency in Oregon as part of the way that we plan for managing our water resources into the future. So we developed a report that's called Making Water Work. It's at the printers right now. If I had copies of it, I would have passed them out to you, but I will certainly email them to you. Actually, the PDF is available now. You can read it online. And there's also an executive summary if you want the short version. So one of the recommendations in that report is that we continue the split-season in-stream leasing program. It's a great program. It would be a shame to see it go away. Organizations like Freshwater Trust, Deschutes River Conservancy, Klamath Basin, Rangeland Land Trust have had a lot of success in working with growers around the state. It's a program that benefits both the environment and the growers because they can grow their crop during the spring and then lease their water in stream during the summer, which is when the fish and the rivers need it most. So it benefits both, as I think that you heard about in the video presentation at the hearing last week. So, and the program did get off to a slow start, and I think that that has been true for many of the state's water conservation programs. It's also true for this program that's called the Allocation of Conserved Water Program. I think the way things tend to happen is that, for one, the Water Resources Department doesn't have a lot of resources to put into outreach and letting people know that these programs are available. It's really up to these other partner organizations that do that. And then I think the way that things tend to happen in the agricultural community is somebody has to try out the program, see that it works for them, and then their neighbors, people nearby, might see that it's working out for them and try it. So things kind of grow slowly, and it's just beginning to start to take off. So it would be a shame to end the program now. So anyways, I urge you to pass Senate Bill 1513 this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Teresa. Joe?
Oh, yeah, there's a question.
Okay. Yep.
Thanks. Thanks for your testimony. Again, you know, we've only had 12 of these in about 10 years. And so now you've gone out and done a little bit more outreach, and maybe we had the presentation, sound like a good presentation. Maybe some farmers can put this to work. I mean, the sunset's in 2014. We've only had 12 of these people sign up and use this. And do you see a big influx of, like, 20 or 30 more people maybe going to do this this summer? I mean, and if so, I'd like to, I think that would
actually
give us
Senator
a
Thompson
look.
I know that that the next speaker is going to speak to that, so can you hold on to your question
sure.
for a minute? And
I guess my question is,
yeah,
if we're going to get a big influx of people using this program, we might be better off to wait till 2014 so we can get look at the usage
so,
better.
So I'm going to let Joe, why don't you go ahead and give your testimony, and then maybe you can address Senator Thompson's issue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Whitworth. I am president of the Freshwater Trust. We've been around for about 30 years, and in fact, we were the nation's first water trust that pioneered this in Oregon to recognize in-stream water rights as a beneficial use. That has been copied throughout the Northwest and around the country, and increasingly we see this as a way to find a balance between in-stream and out-of-stream needs. I co-chair the Water Subcommittee of the Global Warming Commission, along with Phil Ward. I am a member of the Ag Water Quality Advisory Committee, I have been for the better part of a decade, and I sit on the Policy Advisory Group of the Integrated Water Resource Strategy. And in a region that has seen its fair share of environmental fights over the years, whether it's over owls versus timber or fish versus farms, or now we've got the wolf wars to contend with. The old way of the win-lose is kind of coming to its end. And so what we have tried to do is find ways that are voluntary and collaborative so that we can balance those needs. And Senate Bill 1513, as it represents the split-season water lease, is actually one of the lowest hurdles that I have ever seen to be able to do that. What it affords landowners to do is to manage their property and their assets therein to do the best they can from a profit standpoint. That water is most useful to the waterways late in the season, and it is the least productive during those times. And we like to believe that the landowners we work with can do math, and in fact they do. We try to make that math as good as we can, but we are under our own budgetary constraints to make that happen. And so for me, I look at those 14 leases. I wish it was more, but culture being what it is, when you're talking to landowners about how they manage their water, it's a slow process. We can't get into a slick advertising campaign. I don't think that's going to carry a lot of traction with landowners, and I don't think it's honestly an appropriate way to have a discussion with a landowner about the water that they have. We do have And I'm kind of skipping ahead. I'm not really following my testimony as written because I wanted to speak plainly. You can get bogged down in the technical stuff of this, but the bottom line is this is a good way for landowners achieve financial value for their water rights in a way that they couldn't otherwise do it, in a way that keeps the water right fully intact and doesn't harm juniors. We have, I think, 14 leases have been done over the years. It represents about 25 CF cubic feet per second. A cubic foot per second is about 700,000 gallons a day. These generally run for a couple weeks to a month, and so we're talking about 9 million gallons of water, which is huge benefit to these streams. Leases have happened in Marion County, Jackson County, Grant County, Wasco County, Cook, Deschutes, and the Umatilla. We have 8 or so landowners right now looking at this year. And honestly, one of the reasons why we would like to get the sunset removed now is so these people can plan. We're talking about agricultural producers looking more than a couple of years ahead. And I think that because the way this is constructed, if we come back every 5 years, you're talking about operations of growers that are trying to make a buck, and it ain't easy, and are looking at doing some generational planning as well. And this is just one piece of their entire operation. And we think it's a good piece. I mean, you know, those 14, we wish it was more, but still 14. And it was 14 good business decisions. It wasn't a water grab by conservation. These were 14 good business decisions. And in the world, in all these conversations that I'm in, all these stakeholder groups, which I think Senator Olson's comments about where is it easier to make a change? I think in some cases it's probably here. To be honest, going through those stakeholder meetings they're long and they're tedious. And you know what we've got to do is find ways where we can just create the tools and allow the tools that enable landowners to make good decisions in a way that. You know, we're benefiting at least 5 listed species, and I don't think there is a producer out there that wouldn't like NOAA fisheries a little less on their back than they are right now. Water at critical times helps those fish return those numbers, and we've got to have that longer term. So I think that, you know, my understanding of the purpose of a sunset is to see if a law is, if it's completely not working, if it does cause injury, we can yank it. I think you didn't hear from Water Resources testimony that we've had any complaints at all. There is certainly enough injury analysis on this, as with any water transfer, that protects those junior waters, and we don't want to see that going away. We think it's appropriate to engage in careful analysis and make a good decision so that we can, you know, move ahead when it makes good sense. When it doesn't make sense, we don't want to do it. We don't want to do a water lease where it doesn't make good sense. And so where we're at, we would love to see this sunset clause removed. And primarily our motivation is to be able to allow landowners to plan ahead, make some decisions. And, you know, I expect, you know, in the next couple of years, we're going to see at least those 8 additional, and we're going to see, I would like to say some more. But I don't know, you know, I'm not a marketing expert. I can just work with landowners and hope for the best. I'm happy to take any questions at all.
Senator, did you have additional questions?
No, I didn't. I don't.
Okay. I do. Okay. Couple questions. Of the 14 leases, how many of those leases, how many of the did the farmers lease to other farmers?
How many of, oh, these are...
Of the 14 leases, split stream leases, did they all lease to conservation groups? Were all leased by conservation groups, or did some other farmer come in and say, I'd like to lease some of your water because I could use it?
Well, of the 14, I believe those were conservation-based. So I think we can figure out from Water Resources if there were other leases that happened farm to farmer.
Okay. And I can understand why you can use it for tool management because it can enhance fisheries.
Senator, I just want to, for the record, though, it's only for in-stream. If there was actually another farmer that wanted to use it, they would have to go through the transfer provisions through water.
Okay.
It's a whole different.
So if a farmer wants to use it, he has to transfer it. He can't lease it.
Correct, and that would have to go through the Water Resources Department. That's a separate process.
Okay, that's fine. That's good. That's all I need to know.
Okay.
Do you lease the water in low water years? If it's anticipated that we're going to have a low water year, will you still pay for the lease?
You bet.
Okay. So it's kind of like renting a car and putting it in the garage and never driving it.
Well,
but you do see a benefit to it.
Oh, we do see a benefit to it. I mean, we're working with landowners. Some landowners do it, year over year, and they want to take a look and see, what's the water year going to look like, and can I make? There are some years that where they'll look at it and say they just do the math. In a low water year, some crops will do better. I mean, fetch a better price, and they'll just make that calculation. In a high water year, they may or may not. I mean, sometimes I hope we don't get taken for a ride too much, but sometimes we do buy water in a year when the stream doesn't need it as badly in another one. And in that case, what an ag producer is doing is evening out, his chances as against a global commodities market, which we think that's a good thing long term. And it does help. It does help in a very subtle way with regard to the marketing and outreach. I mean, I personally believe the best spokesman for water conservation are new pickups. So if a guy can do a deal with us and still get his new F-350, then his neighbors are going to like that, and they might say, hey, how did you do that? I understand you're doing conservation. And say, hey, you know what? It paid.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, one follow-up mm-hmm. question. In 2001, according to your testimony here, the letter from you, in 2001 it was first enacted, and there was a sunset extended to 2007, and then it was supposed to go to 2014. And following up on Senator Thompson, since you've only got 14, and we apparently want to expand this program, why don't you just move the sunset out another 5 years, and that's fits into the margin, and then we can see that everything works, and then you can just drop it instead of just getting rid of it now.
Senator Olson, Madam Chair, I think it comes down to if we do that, we decrease certainty for landowners, and we keep government in the business of helping landowners manage their land. We just as soon remove those encumbrances and let them manage their own land and make some decisions going forward. I understand that, I think we all would like to see and know that everything that we deal with as a state in terms of policy is off and going and working, and we like to be able to check back in on, and where we're at is probably makes good sense to have the expert agencies riding herd on that. I think if there were real problems, we'd all know about it, and I'd cop to it here. But I think for our purposes, it really comes down to how can we help those landowners in their planning now, as opposed to kind of keeping them up in the air. You're always going to have folks when the legislature is in session, out of session. People are making decisions, trying to make a buck, trying to get by all the time. And if we just force them to live in 5-year increments, not knowing if they want to do a 6th year or a 7th year, then I think it just increases the uncertainty on their part. So, in all things being equal, our preference is to give those landowners the option and this tool in the toolbox for the landowner, for the fisheries, and for water resources.
One follow-up.
Last follow-up.
Last one. You had commented that, get the government out of the way so that they can manage their land. But I believe it was the government itself that allowed them to do the split-stream leasing. So I think it would behoove the government to make sure that they watched what was going on for a period of time. 2001 to 2012, that's only 10 years. And in those 10 years, you had 14 split seasons. As a legislature that's supposed to be up here to oversee, that's why I would suggest that, we just extend the sunset and then look at it for 15 years and say, this works perfectly, get rid of it. Because we were the ones, not me personally, but we, the legislature, were the ones that began this market, started this market. It was never available to them before. And now they've seen the good side of it, which is good. It obviously is beneficial. But maybe, if we made sure that it worked right, instead of just arbitrarily saying, well, it's been here for 10 years, we haven't had a problem, but we've only had 14. If we extended it to 2017... 2015, and then looked at it again and said, well, we've got 50 now and there's still no problem. Let's get rid of it. That's what I think our job is as oversight.
Vice Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I certainly would not want to see this body or any other committee abrogate its duty to make sure that, you know, we're accountable to this program and the agencies are doing it, promulgating in the way that it should be. But I think sometimes in the legislative and in the administrative process, we forget about people trying to plan ahead. And I do think it's an important factor that, again, needs to be balanced. I believe that it's been balanced with the work that the Water Resources Department has done and will continue to do around, you know, reviewing this on an ongoing basis. And as Chair Dingfelder noted, you know, regulations, if there are needed to be changes, they still have to go through all of the due steps that need to happen to ensure that this is done in a very accountable way.
Thank you very much. We will hear from a couple more folks, and then we're going to have to move on to our next issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kate Richard, Kosasan. And also, we have one more person signed up, Eric Kanzler. Is Eric here? Why don't you go ahead and get started, Richard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Richard Kosasan, Water for Life. With respect to 1513, I think, first of all, I'd like it on the record for Water for Life would like some changes to the bill, but in no manner would we like to see the split season use provisions go away. As indicated time and again, since the inception of the program in 2001, there have been 14 split season leases. To me, that would speak again to a further look in the future. And I would support Senator Olson's, I think, train of thought is to extend the program and look at the benefits and look at any potential detrimental impacts resulting from split season leases, say 6 years down the road. But if one were to take a hard look at the provisions as written, 537-348, provisions in subsection 1 of the existing statutory framework speak to the protections found in the transfer statutes, and those are at 540-585. Those same provisions are not included in subsections 2 and 3 of the bill. And that has been the way that the statutory framework has been in place, I think, since 2001. So to look at the bill and consider the measure, I would encourage strongly the committee to look at those existing protections found in the transfer statutes. Specifically, what water is subject to transfer? That is contained in 540-505. The notice, the application, and the standing protections afforded in 540-520. Those transfer statutes have been in place for years, allowing some flexibility, but allowing protections by other water right holders. In terms of a continuation of the program, we would support. In terms of clarification of a lease, we would support the language, I believe, that was contained in House Bill 2983 from last session, which stipulated the duration or term of a lease would be subject to a 5-year term with potential for renewal. It is my understanding that that is contained in administrative rule to date. I would bring the committee's attention, 5-year period, I think, makes some logical sense in terms of conformity with rule and conformity with existing statutes as they are found in 540-610 dealing with the forfeiture of water. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but again, we provided the committee with two sets of amendments, -1 and -2. The -1 clarifies the protections contained in the entire three subsections of 537-348. Second amendment, again, clarifies those protections, but would continue the sunset for a period of 6 years.
Thank you, Richard. Questions for Mr. Costasan? I have one, Richard. So what makes you think with a few more years, or what I thought I heard, I think we all heard, that there's been no problems with the program so far, and you actually just said that you support the program, don't want to see it go away. Do you think that do you anticipate problems in the future? What will 2 years, I'm trying to figure out what a couple of years of additional data will gain us here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A higher degree of use of the program in terms of the application of the split season use in more settings, I think, would be wonderful. But in terms of previous comments of absolute protection for perhaps junior users, one has to keep in mind we could have 3 or 4 or 5 normal years. You could have a short season and a short water season. And in terms of the injury was there, the underlying injury was always there. But because of normal water years, it was never experienced. That irrigator, all of a sudden, might be short of water. He doesn't really have 30, 60, 90 days, perhaps, to wait for recourse and remedies. Some people need water in terms of production agriculture tomorrow and not 30 days down the road.
Okay, and in that line of, I guess, to follow up on your comment then, why would this be different from, for instance, any other injury test with a water transfer, which we do in much greater number, which I think your organization is supportive of the transfer statute. So we just heard that the same type of injury test applies. So why would it be any different for an in-stream versus a junior water right holder using that water?
Madam Chair, because I think the way the statute in 537.348 was constructed, and I don't think it has been implemented in that way. The department, I think, has done a very good job in terms of the promulgation of rules for protections. But those are indeed in rules. And on a close read of 537.348, again, the transfer statutes and the protections of the transfer statutes only extend to the provisions found in subsection 1. And on a literal reading, they do not extend to the provisions in subsections 2 and 3 of the same section.
Okay. Well, just to clarify, we'll probably have the department come up and address that. But why don't we hear from Eric first? And then I'd like the department to come up, but from what I'd heard, that there would be the same level of injury test applied. I'd like to hear what the department has to say. Eric?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Kanzler, and I'm the Executive Director of the Network of Oregon Watershed Councils. The network is a 501c3 office that was formed just shy of 6 years ago to support the work of our member councils throughout the state. At this point, there are roughly 90 watershed councils throughout the state working within their local communities and with a diverse array of stakeholders and very collaborative projects on issues ranging from flow restoration to habitat restoration, education, research, and beyond. I'm here on behalf of the network office to encourage the legislature's continued support of split season in-stream water leasing. This is a very important and completely voluntary means, as you've heard, of balancing the needs of irrigators with the goals of restoring our watersheds. The watershed councils throughout the state both promote and participate in the split season lease program. From our perspective, as we've heard before, it's just one more tool. It's not the solution, it's not an end-all be-all, but we have suites of tools that we use that are adaptive and some fit for certain circumstances and some fit for others, and this is one that we like to have available to us, and it's one that helps the councils and partners and other interests pursue their goals, as I said, in an adaptive fashion. This is a very simple bill and from our perspective a very significant bill. Given the critical importance to find opportunities for farmers and irrigators and ranchers and conservation interests and other stakeholders to come together for mutual benefit and to address shared goals. Split season leases are a great way to develop relationships between these stakeholders, and those opportunities are critically important these days in finding ways to address these problems. And our hope is that lifting the sunset is going to continue to promote the dialogue on this issue. It's going to continue to encourage collaborative investment in these processes, and doing so will allow the work that's gone into these leases to continue to serve as an example of how all these different interests can work together and hopefully encourage similar participation in other processes throughout the state going forward. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Eric. Any questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, and if the department can come back up and quickly answer that question, then we're going to move on to the next public hearing.
Madam, excuse me, Madam Chair, for the record, Tom Paul, Water Resources Department. If you look at Oregon Revised Statute 537.348, Section 1 of that starts out and says any person may purchase or lease all or a portion of, and it keeps on going. Mm-hmm. If you drop down to Section 2, again, it says any person, and it relates to a lease of all or a portion, so that seems to tie back to the Section 1. And then Section 3 at the bottom says a lease of all or a portion. Again, it seems to be pointing back to Section 1 that talks about a person may lease. Section 3 gives further requirements if you are going to do it for split season, but it's still talking about a lease.
Okay. So it applies, it actually gives further requirements than it would under a normal
Madam lease. Chair, that's the way we would interpret it, yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I think when you, Mr. Paul, excuse me, I think when you read that first part on 537.348, Section 1, you read the first couple sentences, but you forgot down at near the bottom of that section, it says a person who transfers a water right by purchase, lease, or gift under this subsection. So in other words, shall comply with requirements for the transfer of water right under OS 540, 505, 540, 585. So only subsection 1
that's being taken out, isn't it?
Is included. And that's why I think the question was brought that subsection 2 and 3 were not included in that particular context.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. And when I talked through, I said section 1, section 2, section 3.
You're right.
It does say subsection. I'm not sure what the subsection is referring to. But still, our read is that it's pointing to a lease of all or a portion of a water right.
Thank you for that clarification. And with that, we don't have anybody else signed up to testify. Anybody else like to testify on this week before we close the public hearing? Mr. Myron, if you can come up quickly, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Myron, for the record. I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon, and we want to just go on record in support of this legislation. It is a, you know, the toolbox analogy has been a little overplayed today, but it's, you know, this is maybe a 3-inch crescent wrench and not a 16-inch spud wrench, but it could be a valuable tool in certain instances. Thank you.
Thank you for that little interpretation of the toolbox. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1513, and we will open up our last public hearing on Senate Bill 1508. Beth, if you can tell us about the bill.
Yep. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1508 would allow two or more beverage distributors to establish a cooperative for specified purposes. It would also require the distributor cooperative and any distributor or importer who is not participating in the cooperative to provide to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission a report of beverage container return data by July 1st of each year. There are dash 2 and dash 3 amendments in your packet for your review.
Okay, so we have some people signed up. Rick Winterhalter, Joe Gilliam, and Paul Romaine. She'll figure it out. Yeah, you know why? They're related.
Yeah, I know they're brothers.
He just whispered and said, you sort of look like Representative Gilliam. I said, I don't think they know each other.
Who?
Okay.
You got a representative from what? For the record.
He's on the other side of the building.
Oh, I'll go over and look. For the record, my name is Joe Gilliam, president of Northwest Grocery Association. I don't know where the other gentlemen are, but I'll go ahead and open up for you.
Yes,
I know we've got
go ahead.
Very little time. I know you've had an informational hearing on this already. My representation is for retailers who really handle about 80% of the capacity of the model bill in the state of Oregon in terms of redemption. We're here today to support 1508 and also the amendments that have been brought forward, the Dash 3 amendments. We'll also support those. This bill is important for two reasons. It's a closing the loop for the legislative action in 2007, Senate Bill 707, and also our bill last session, 3145, in closing two important areas. One is a little protection for the retailers. With the change in the law that all retailers have to take back the type of beverage they sell rather than the brand of beverage, that changed the entire landscape of the Oregon bottle bill from what it originally was. So you have a far different process of collecting containers and clearing the nickels that go back and forth between retailers, distributors, and consumers. That one change is the birth of the OBRC and put those all the processing plants together. So for in order for us to operate the bottle bill as has been passed and 3145, this bill is extremely important in the back room where no one sees it. It's not about the consumer issue, but it's about sorting and returning containers and getting them back to the system. This bill allows the retailer to have the protection that if some distributors choose not to join OBRC or any other co-op that is doing the majority of the state's operation, the retailer doesn't have to have the extra expense and cost of separate sorting of all these containers. And it's not just the containers we sell. It could be any container, a brand we don't even have, and have to have a separate sort for all that. What this does, it allows the retailers to have one system in the back room, one set of sorting containers, and it all goes back to the system and goes back to recycling. That's the first part of the bill. The second part of the bill is, and particularly the Dash 3 amendments, help us to do the appropriate calculations for House Bill 3145 from last session that sets up all the triggers in case there's a trigger for a dime or a trigger for expansion and all those things. Your calculation is in this bill to get you there. So with that, and given the time, I'll take any questions.
Thanks. Why don't we have Mr. Romaine talk, and then we'll take questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. I won't repeat what Joe said, but basically, when you the bottle bill is an unnatural system. It usually, in most instances, things are delivered to the consumer, and then the consumer is responsible for basically getting rid of it. What you've done with the bottle bill, back from 1971 on, is mandate a return system. The old bottle bill was based upon exclusive territories. It was a simple system to operate. When we went into containers that were coming into the state in different ways than beer and soda, we had to figure out another way to handle them. And that's what OBRC is. That's what this bill is about. It's about accounting for the containers that come in and making sure the bottle bill actually operates. So we would not be here asking you for this if there were no bottle bill to mandate any, or not mandate, but just to allow for what we have in the bill. The bottom line is, and we thought some other people would be up here first, there is no antitrust concern with this. We have an opinion from the Perkins Coie law firm based upon previous legislation. I've been involved with a number of antitrust cases. I sort of do that as a sidebar issue, and there really isn't an antitrust issue here. It might be raised as a smokescreen. What we're trying to do here is put in a system that makes the bottle bill work, makes you proud of it. We think we have done that. Frankly, we've had people come out from Iowa to look at our system and other states. We are considered to be the most progressive state in the country at the least cost to the consumer to actually get these things back into the system. So we would commend this to you and appreciate your support.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Senator Przanski.
Just one question. Joe, when you were giving your presentation, I thought I heard you say that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that if a person brings a container back to a store that doesn't actually sell that product, do they actually have to receive, or is it actually received now? Because I've actually had cans and stuff kick out.
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, yes. So if a Costco Kirkland bottle comes back to Fred Meyer's has to take it in, as they do at Albertson's can, Safeway can,
okay.
You know, and it works the other way in the stream. So as you can imagine, with all these going back and forth now where you don't have a direct trail to where you go get your nickel,
right?
That's why you have a statewide co-op now in order to, they take care of that and then clearinghouse all the nickels, all the brands, and it goes back into recycling. So it is correct. So if you're getting something kicked out that, it, because it's brand, if you're going to say, look, they can't say, we don't take that brand. Now, for some reason, let's say they just sell water and soda, don't sell beer, they don't have to take beer back.
Right.
But if they sell one brand of beer?
Don't say beer up here.
If they sell one brand of soda?
Bad example.
They have to take back all brands of soda.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Hess.
Thank you. Joe, could you tell us where we are with redemption centers, how they're working, and whether or not this is part of that picture?
We had an informational hearing that the senator should not attend, so I missed that. But
not to get into the disciplinary
action.
I just want to get it in perspective.
Give us the high points.
Madam Chair, Senator Hass, we do have two redemption centers running, one in Wood Village, one in Oregon City. The idea and the operation is probably too good an idea at this point. We are over capacity. In the first redemption center, we shut down two stores and replaced it with a redemption center of 9 million units that were going through the stores. That center is now taking in over 20 million units per year, so over twice of what we shut down. They're coming from as far away as 8 miles as a crow flies, which is a long way when you think about, you know, coming through Gresham from Sandy. We have a drop-off, so you can put them in a bag, drop them off, go on a count. We have hand counting, and we have reverse vending machines. Oregon City's is just as popular and is going like crazy. And so we are doing the pilot project with Passing 3145 in Salem, opening, we hope, March 9th. Do not, you know, put that in a piece of concrete.
I was writing
it down. Use pencil.
Right now.
Use pencil. But it looks good. It is the new model where there is a much wider ring. We'll have, I think we have 8 retailers signed up for that one. It'll take in a capacity of about 23 million units. And you know, we'll learn some things along the way, but with the data we've learned from the first two, it looks like it's going to be a pretty slick operation.
Okay. Other questions?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I'll go first. Mr. Gilliam, I've been to the Oregon City store. As a matter of fact, I live in Cami and I take my cans in. my first question would be, how does that impact my retailers when I buy my soda in Canby and deposit them in Oregon City?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, well, it does help. When you do that, it does help your local retailer. So Cutsforth Thriftway, if you're buying there and taking to Oregon City, he's not having to take them back
right.
in. So it's cutting his expenses a little bit. We don't have good enough data to get where is there enough reduction, you know, how far out it goes, because it's kind of you're kind of skimming off the top and going in. You have the stores that are right near there shut down, so there's all that capacity plus more. We have 100 folks that are Malala who have signed up, so they're even farther than anywhere you live and come in for the convenience of it all. But it does save those retailers the cost of bringing it in. It is choking us at Oregon City just because of the convenience. Are you in one of the counts, the bag drop accounts?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That convenience people really want. Eventually, what will happen is we'll probably have something in Canby as we go out and build these out, so those retailers will be relieved of their whole duty and shut their bottle rooms down and actually have one center in the center town.
Follow up, and then I'm going to have Senator Thompson go. We have three people from over 100 miles, so I want to make sure we can hear them.
Yeah. I guess what I'm getting to is when I buy my soda from Thriftway, I give them the nickel, and then I drop the cans off someplace else. How does this differ if you're in Eastern Oregon and they buy their bottle someplace and drop them off someplace else? What's the impact, and why does that group out there need to belong to this co-op?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it's our purpose for the bill is it's not a need to have them join the co-op. They're welcome not to join the co-op as far as I'm concerned. They don't want to join, that's fine. I couldn't care one way or the other. The purpose is that when they don't join the co-op, because we're under the mandate of the bottle bill and how we have to collect it. So the answer to your question about the nickels is your nickel goes in at Cutsforth. it goes into the OBRC. Those cans go to the redemption center. They get, that's where it happens.
Okay.
Cutsforth is made whole. He's in good shape. No problems. You're made whole. You got your nickel. If the gentlemen from Eastern Oregon don't want to join, that's fine. But you're trying to make a bottle bill work with this new mechanism that you have to take anything in. That means you have to work as a group. If those who don't want to work in the group, dandy, don't raise my cost to do it. You're causing me, because of your choice, now I have to do separate sorts in the back room, I have to pull out separate material, I have more labor costs, it ups the price. So you're disadvantaging the retailers in those areas. What this bill says is, don't join, but we don't have to return the cans anymore, we don't have the separate sort, and you return our nickels and the system will run just fine. Go do your thing and have a nice day.
Okay. Senator Thompson, a quick question.
I was just kind of in the same thing, Mr. Chair. How according to this bill, so how would joining the OBRC help those Eastern Oregon distributors that aren't in it do a better job of collecting? Would that help them?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, being part of the system, it's my opinion that being in the system would be better. I don't know their business. I don't know. You know, I've never ridden in one of their trucks or gone with them to pick up cans. So I can't definitively say it's perfect for their business. But when you talk about the bottle bill, this is a government policy of what we'll do at store level. So we've been mandated with an operation. We don't get paid for any of this. The only money in the system is with distributors. So for a distributor under the new law to be allowed to increase our costs and cost us twice the labor in the back room isn't a very fair, equitable deal. If they don't want to join because they don't feel like they're getting any service or value for the fees they'd pay into the co-op, then they shouldn't join, but they shouldn't impact the retailer in that process. And so what this bill does is says, because we've been participants in the bottle bill for the last 30-plus years, and we bear all the costs at retail with no reimbursement, it's recognizing the fact that we're not going to allow the new piece of 707 to increase our costs. And they can do whatever they want. Get in, get out, sit down, you know, whatever's good for their books. Okay. I'm not going to tell them what's good for their books. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Paul, quickly.
Joe answered. Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, what this is just a pooling of the nickels. And, in effect, you take all the nickels in, and we don't know where those containers get redeemed. I mean, they could be bought in Le Grand and redeemed in Scappoose, for all we know. So it's just a central bank that's been set up to try and redeem the stuff. And everybody has pooled their resources to try and figure out how to pick up every container that's out there. And that's all it is. Everybody's pooling their resources. And frankly, if there's money left over, those distributors get extra money. You had opposition from another person last time who really loves the system now because he joined it and actually found that it works beautifully for him. That was a person from Astoria who you don't see here anymore. The system works very well if people would just kind of look at it. If they choose not to and impose additional costs on the grocer, the whole idea is how do you get the grocer to have a little bit of extra money to cover the cost, and that is by keeping the scrap. So the grocer can sell the scrap rather than having this person who's imposed the cost sell the scrap.
Okay, we're running out of time, gentlemen. Thank you. We have three people that came from over 100 miles, so I want to make sure we get to hear them today. Gary Purcell, Russell Strandholm. Is that right? Okay. And Ron Bruce. Sorry to keep you, but, you know, we save the best for last, so there you go.
We hope you didn't get more than 3 or 4 minutes. Anyway.
You've got about 8, so hopefully if you have a similar message, maybe you can sort of coordinate a little bit. So.
Right. Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for coming here.
Uh-huh. We have our own association that we formed in Eastern Oregon. At one time, there was 3 other members, one of them being Astoria. They've worked out special deals with OBRC.
Oh, and can you please state your name for the record, please?
For the record?
Yes.
My name's Russ Strandholm, and I'm with Hodgen Distributing in Pendleton, Oregon.
Thank you.
And plus, we've formed the Oregon Association of Independent Beverage Recyclers. Like I stated earlier, Madam Chair, the wholesaler in Astoria
struck his own deal with OBRC to join. We have reached out to OBRC three or four times the last 3 years trying to work out something. It's always kind of been it's their way or the highway. And the reason we, myself, hasn't joined, being a beer wholesaler, is because the added cost of the best I can figure between $35,000 and $45,000 a year. Plus, I would lay off an employee and a half. And the way we're recycling right now has worked excellent for us since the impression, or since 1971 of the bottle bill. As you can see in that one handout, I was awarded in 2011 Recycler of the Year from Pelton Sanitary Service. They do all my processing, and I do my own pickup. And probably being we're kind of short on time, I'll let these guys go ahead and speak, Madam Chair and Senators.
Thank you.
My name is Gary Proschel. I'm the president and owner of Pendleton Bottling Company in Pendleton, Oregon. I think the first thing I'd like to start off with is correct a few misconceptions that were here today. One thing that Joe said was that because of the way we operate, the stores have to sort separately. That, of course, is not true. The way this works in Eastern Oregon, there's about 10 stores that have machines that you put your can in. It crushes the can, reads the code, so that the store knows that they just redeemed a Pepsi can. All those are crushed. There is no separate sorting. When you get to the back room, it says, okay, Pendleton Bottling has about 10 bags worth of recycle that they need to pick up, so we pick up whatever the store says we should. But there is no separate recycling. Those 10 stores do about 90% of the recycling in the Pendleton market. A second question I think one of you gentlemen asked was, sometimes I put a can in and it drops out. I'd point out to the group that any can of Pepsi, Diet Pepsi, Mountain Dew, Dr. Pepper, Diet Dr. Pepper, and several other brands that were purchased in Washington and have a separate UPC code are not redeemable in the state of Oregon. One of the biggest fears that we have over on the east side of the state in places like Milton Freewater and Walla Walla is that we'll be overwhelmed by misredemptions from outside of the state of Oregon. So in other words, we're refunding a nickel that we never collected in the first place, and that, of course, is very unfair and raises the costs for everyone in the state of Oregon. So one of the proactive things that we've done is to avoid that by having separate UPC codes so that if you bought your can in Idaho or California or Washington, that can will not be redeemed through those machines. So there's no separate sorting. All soda that is sold in the state of Oregon is redeemable in those machines. And one last comment. One of the things is they didn't think it was fair for us to try to force costs onto the rest of the onto the grocers. One of the things in our proposal that was on the last page of your handout, I'd point to number 6. In the event that any redemption centers are opened in our territories, the Eastern Oregon area, we would be willing to pay our fair share of the redemption center cost. In an effort to ensure that the redemption centers met the needs of consumers of Eastern Oregon, we would need to be involved in the site selection. The entire OBRC, Oregon Association of Independent Beverage Recyclers, problem is a lack of trust with the way OBRC originally tried to jam their contract down our throats. We had a meeting with John Anderson right after that bill was passed. It was a great meeting. We all said, great, let's get together, let's work on this contract. 6 or 8 months later, we had a meeting in Pendleton, Oregon, where they came, slapped down the contract, said, this is it, sign it, or else. Now, that's not the way to gain, you know, consensus. People support things they help create. That's elementary management. You know, we all learned that as freshmen in college. But that's not what happened here. So we were willing, and, you know, for whatever reason, they decided they needed to write it over in Portland and not involve anyone else. Now, there's eight Pepsi-Cola bottlers in the state of Oregon. Of those eight bottlers, there was two that were involved in the negotiation, Portland and Eugene. Both of them got guaranteed seats on the board of directors of the Oregon OBRC. They joined. The other six of us, who got no special deal, we didn't join. So that's kind of a history of what happened and why there's this impasse. Essentially, all this bill does is I buy a can and fill it with soft drinks, sell it to my customer, and charge him a deposit. My agreement on that deposit is I'm going to charge you a nickel, and if you give me my can back, I'm going to give you your nickel back. That's the deal that we've had for the last 40 years in the state of Oregon. This bill changes that deal and says that that can no longer belongs to Pendleton Bottling anymore. It belongs to somebody that didn't do anything. They didn't manufacture it. They didn't pay for the can. They didn't charge the deposit. They didn't refund the deposit. They didn't do anything. But yet, this bill is going to give them the ownership of that container. Now, how is that fair? I don't understand that.
So let's, we have a couple more minutes left for your testimony, and then we'll see if there's any questions before we adjourn. So you get the last word.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Bruce. I'm a Pepsi bottler in Eastern Oregon, LeGrand in Ontario. Some of you know where Ontario's at. That's on the border. We over-redeem right now. We are taking care of the bottle bill as it was voted through the state. We pick up our empties, deposit containers. Joe Gilliam made a great statement, and I can't agree with him more, about the 8 miles is a long ways from Redemption Center. I have one truck that goes 85 miles one way every day. Takes care of several little towns, several little areas. We take care of all of our grocers there. We take care of the supermarkets, the C-stores, and the small grocers. So in our geography and that side of the state, we travel an awful lot. We're at these accounts. We're taking care of our accounts. And I would implore every one of you to please ask our grocers if we do a good job keeping their back rooms cleaned out with deposit containers. You know, the last bill that's basically the same as this bill was pushed pretty quick in a special session a year ago or so. And to Paul Romaine's statement, Perkins and Cooey did an analysis of this antitrust policy, and it was also done by an Aubertine and Associates and another group of fellows out of Portland. It was enough evidence that the governor, the former governor, and his legal team felt that there was an issue there. So I would just please ask you guys to, and ladies, to please look at this and take a, sorry,
all right.
A little nervous here.
All right.
just look at those analyses that are here at the Capitol. And I just ask to be real careful. There's another side to this. We're doing a great job amongst ourselves. A gentleman that's injured a little bit couldn't make it. Between Budweiser, a Peony distributing, and ourselves, we're taking care of the deposit containers. The other big issue of this is the scrap. It is built into our business model. We do employ people to take care of this. I don't want to see any jobs lost. I could lose two people over this bill.
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you, gentlemen, for coming here today. I know you came a long way. I do know where Ontario is, and I've been many, many times. It's one of my favorite parts of the state. I do appreciate you bringing your concerns and comments forward, and here's what is the intention of the chair. We have a member of this committee has offered to put together a work group in a very expedited fashion because you know we have a short session. That work group is going to convene here pretty shortly, staffed by our committee staff, Beth Petrino. So I just want to make sure that you know that your concerns are being heard. We're going to try our best to see if we can resolve something. And Senator Thompson has volunteered to head up that effort. So with that, unless there's a couple of quick questions, Senator Krasinski? Yep.
So just clarification for myself, the way that you're working now and the way of your picking up the recyclables is the traditional way, not using an automatic machine, or how's that your system
now
working?
We are using the automatic machine, so we get a printout from the store and write a credit based on that, and then we pick up our share of the recycle.
Okay, so what I was told by the other side, the way their systems work sounds very similar in the sense of can goes in, machine demarcates whose can it is, so there's a running tally or total, so you know exactly how many are coming in. Of course, that we encrushed all that. So the one question, I guess, I heard over redeeming. It seems to me now, if we're all using these systems, the out-of-state cans shouldn't be making it through the system.
They do make it through the system because, except for those brands that I mentioned, all other brands can be redeemed in the machine, even if they were purchased out of state.
So let me ask one of the questions, if I could. Would it be beneficial for the state, if we can do this, not sure federally, if we're preempted or not, require some type of barcode that's unique to Oregon for all products that are sold in Oregon, no matter what the containers and what the beverage is?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator, I've gone to, like, Anheuser-Busch and tried to get them to make a separate barcode for the state of Washington and for the state of Oregon, which there was up till about 5 years ago. And Anheuser-Busch, when they got bought out, they cut corners, and they only make one barcode now.
Yeah.
And so I get really a lot of over-redemption.
That's why I support craft beers.
Okay. Yeah. 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 Okay, real quickly, and then we're going to have to adjourn. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator, to answer that also, you know, there's a lot of grocery stores that do not have a reverse vendor, a small grocer, a C-store.
Right.
They're not going to look at that can to see if it came from Oregon or
I understand
or
that.
Idaho, Washington. So we redeem it.
I understand that. Yeah, no, that's what I was wondering, if you what systems you're using. I can see on the manual ones how that would happen.
Sure.
Well, thank you again, gentlemen. We are out of time. Certainly, you can follow up if you need to with any additional information via email or to our staff, and we'll make sure and share it. But I will look forward to hearing how the work group goes. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1508. Committee members, I just want to make sure you know that we are going to carry over the possible work session for Senate Bill 1513, Senate Bill 1511, and Senate Bill 1508, because these were all posted for work session. And with that, we are adjourned.